From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
You're listening to Money Talk for July 16th, 2021. Your Milwaukee Brewers are in Cincinnati all weekend, and with the NBA Finals tied 2-2, the Bucks head back to Phoenix for Game 5 against the Suns on Saturday. Let's go, Bucks. Zoom meetings, for good or bad, are part of business today. Well, a woman working for a nonprofit wore the same Hawaiian shirt to 30 Zoom meetings in a row, and nobody noticed. So she thought it would be fun to see just how many days she could go before anyone said something. If you guess 264 days, you win. They're called stupid criminals for a reason. In Maine, a man tried to pay his bail with counterfeit $100 bills. Forgery has now been added as an additional charge. In Prague, a woman got out of her car, went into the office, and put in her 9 hours. Notice I never said anything about her shutting off the car, because she didn't. When the police notified her of her running car and the ticket, her response was perfect. Please don't tell my husband. He's always saying I'm too scatterbrained to drive. Speaking of scatterbrained, in New Zealand, a man ran off to a restaurant to get some French fries to go with his steaks. Here's the problem. He put those steaks in the toaster before he left. Ooh. Well, he came home with his fries to a burned-down house, and his insurance denied the claim. I hope those were good fries. And don't worry, I didn't forget about Florida. A man wearing a t-shirt reading, "Who needs drugs? No, seriously, I have drugs," was, not surprisingly, arrested for possession of drugs. Finally, our headline of the week, from the Bozeman, Montana Daily. Astronaut takes blame for gas in space station. On the podcast today, we've got Art Rothschild, Chris Evers, and looking back at the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you, Jason. A rough week overall for markets. The NASDAQ down 1.9% this week. The S&P 500 down 1%. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.5%. Closing today at 34,687, down 300 points today. For the year, however, the Dow still up 14.4, the S&P still up 16, and the NASDAQ still up 12.3%. Quick look at numbers for the week. I think, Chris, as we look at some of the economic indicators in Joel's absence this week, you've done a good job of keeping us apprised of what's going on. I think, important maybe to start out with some of the actual data. And we can talk a little bit more about kind of what it means and how it fits in. But as we look at, in particular, some more inflationary measures that came out in consumer prices and producer prices, things seem to be, maybe a little bit beyond what we had been expecting. We've certainly seen some and heard some from the Fed that inflation's a little bit higher than expected. But the CPI number this last week, certainly far beyond what the expectation was.
I'm happy to carry on the torch for Joel in his absence this week. Let's dive a little bit into the inflation numbers, which is certainly something we've talked about over the last handful of months. And I don't think it should be surprising that inflation numbers are running high. We've talked about this in advance. Specifically looking at CPI that came out on Tuesday, it was the highest reading since August of 2008 with a 5.4% year-over-year increase. If you strip out the more volatile food and energy components of the CPI and look at that, it was actually the highest reading since November of 1991 as well. Now, those are both long time periods, but it's also been a stretch of extremely low inflation as well. So that should be mentioned as we look at that. And some of the areas that are driving that inflationary increase, there's stuff we've talked about on the podcast before. That's within the vehicles market. So both used cars, which were up 10.5%, new vehicles, which rose in price by the most since 1981, and then also energy costs and airline tickets. So these are some of the areas that maybe transitory in some way, and that we've discussed, over the last few weeks as being pieces that have driven inflation numbers higher.
Chris, I think as we talk about some of those issues, and that was a big thing we mentioned on last week's podcast, was that this CPI report would be an important one to watch, just given some of the individual categories It continues to be many of the categories I think that we had expected, although we have seen some improvements in some of the underlying data as far as prices are concerned. You know, in particular, used car prices are one where the actual prices have started to plateau a bit. I think the other important thing to remember is that we're talking about base prices or year-over-year prices that in many of these areas were incredibly depressed. And so that's going to play a role as we look forward as well, that the year-over-year comparisons become a little bit less aggressive as, you know, as we enter an environment where the year before was a more normal economic operating environment. Beyond prices, we got news this last week on retail sales. It's obviously a well-watched indicator with consumer spending being such an important part of our economy.
Yeah, so the two main variables that we've pretty much paid attention to this week were inflation numbers and a look at the consumer. And on the consumer side, we got new information on retail sales as well as consumer sentiment. And I think those two should go hand in hand, as often consumer sentiment is seen as kind of a early reading on what future retail sales will be. And if we look at retail sales, they're up 18% year over year. And it was also a good reading. The only area that we had a slight decrease, again, was to a little bit of a decrease in motor vehicle sales, pointing to the chip shortages we've had in semiconductors, which ties very well to the inflation numbers that we talked about with the lack of inventory there in vehicles. As we look at the consumer sentiment side, again, tying it back to inflationary numbers, we had a drop in consumer sentiment reading. Most of the respondents pointed to concerns over rising prices within vehicles, homes, and larger durable purchases like washing machines and other things for their home. At the same time, consumers mostly said they have more cash than they've had in a while, and personal savings are at a great level. So you kind of have two sides of the equation. People have a lot of money, and they're spending that money, and that's causing prices to go up on a fair amount of the goods that they want.
Well, and I think what's interesting about that, Chris, is that broadly speaking, that's a good thing for the economy, right? When people have money and they're spending it, when people see the prospects of inflation, you'd rather spend today than spend tomorrow when things cost more, because your dollar today is going to go farther. And so I think some of that is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It'll be self-fulfilling for a while, where the expectation of inflation actually creates that inflation. I think more importantly, though, and Art, maybe this is a good time to bring you into the program, you look at the markets this week compared to maybe what we've done so far this year, we didn't get really any terribly bad news outside of inflation being a little worse than expected, outside of maybe some of the earnings reports that came out being great, but not as great as they otherwise could have been. And yet markets sell off somewhat significantly this week, Art. How do you reconcile, you know, for clients who are asking, what should I care about in a week in which markets sold off a little bit, but the news wasn't all that bad? What do you tell a client who's asking that question?
Yeah, it's a pattern we've seen before. It's sort of like buying the rumor and selling the news. It's also a factor of, you know, what really is going on. And you've got traders trading every day, and they're trading on different bits of information. And so we also had Chairman Powell, you know, testifying this week. And earlier in the week, the market embraced his comments. And late last week, of course, we set records. So here we are a week later, all concerned because we're down a point. So there's a question of significance when we started today up 17% on the S&P, and now we're only up 16, give or take. So I think we're having a tremendous year. I think everything's falling into place for a great economic recovery from a terrible, you know, pandemic. So I don't think this is a troubling week at all. It was, as a matter of fact, you need a, you know, some selling, some profit taking every once in a while. You need to see prices go down every once in a while. I haven't looked at the figures lately, but I don't think we've had a 5% decline in stocks in months and months and months, let alone a 10% correction, which is in line with the question we're often asked. You know, hey, when's the next shoe going to drop, or when are we going to have a correction? And to which we should always answer, it could happen anytime. This is normal. But I feel very good about what's going on. Inflation, these numbers, you know, significant, biggest in history, you know, increase in inflation or producer prices. Sure, we were digging out of one of the biggest holes in history. And so, and even though the consumers are starting to talk about inflation, it's like, yeah, because they're hearing about it every day. and you don't have to buy a new car or a used car every day. You're not going to buy a plane ticket every day. And it could slow down economic activity in the future if the supply and demand don't line up. But given our confidence that eventually that will happen, pretty good week, you know, didn't lose too much.
Yeah, I enjoy that you point out that we were up 17 and now we're only up 16. And some people might point to that as a bad week. I'd point to it as a pretty good year so far.
Absolutely.
It's all in how you frame it. I think, you know, we got comments and you forwarded an article that quoted Jeff Gundlach, who's kind of been the stock market bear. As a bond investor, you'd expect him to be bearish on stocks, but he's been more bearish than most. And even still this week, he came out and said, yeah, stocks actually look relatively attractive when compared to some of the other asset classes you might choose to invest in. And specifically, you know, the bonds that he'd typically be buying in his kinds of funds, you know, as you talk about, okay, what are your options? I think it's clear that, yeah, we could see a correction. Yeah, we could see markets take a dive for a variety of reasons, some of them known, some of them unknown. But when you talk about how investors should be positioning a portfolio, it's all with respect to choices. And so, Art, as you look at the landscape, maybe in light of Gundlach's comments that stocks are maybe a little more attractive than what we might have otherwise thought, how do you help investors navigate the choice between all those different investment categories? And in particular, in an environment where stocks maybe look a little expensive, but everything else looks maybe even a little more expensive or a little less attractive relative to?
Kyle, that's about the best question you've ever asked. I hope I give a worthy answer. That's really what we do all day. I mean, we do talk with clients about what they have and for the most part, how well they've done with what they have. And because they've done as well, typically their allocation to the stock market has been going higher year after year. But that is why we periodically rebalance. So one of the most important topics this year, and we've talked about it many, many times on the show, is the rotation from growth stocks to value stocks. Well, at least that was in the first quarter. And then in the second quarter, it's like, oh, growth stocks did better again. And so to a certain extent, value stocks are just plain cheaper on the basis of earnings multiples and the like. And this question of, geez, is this expansion going to stall? Are stocks going to end up being a bad place to be? We don't think so. We think stocks are always a good place to be. So every day, as we navigate through these often troubled waters, we're just trying to fill in places in people's portfolios where they might be underrepresented. For example, we haven't talked about it in a while, emerging markets. We came into this year or late last year, people were saying they're relatively undervalued. And they still are. But it's a riskier area of the market. You don't want to put all your money in there. So every day when I'm doing reviews, I might look at someone's under allocation to emerging markets and say, hey, maybe a little of that. Or growth stocks, which have run so well for 10 years. Someone might have too high of an allocation to growth stocks. What a great time to move some money from growth over to value, not just because we think the baton has been passed, but because they're just plain cheaper. They're good companies. They're undervalued. And then the stock bond conundrum, as we're always talking about, with the yield on the 10-year treasury at 1.3 or whatever it is as we speak, we're constantly looking at durations and not making sure people don't take, excessive risk by going too far out on the yield curve. So we have plenty to do to navigate, but it's been pretty clear sailing, you know, so far this year, other than a few days or weeks.
What I think is interesting about that is that so much of what we do takes place on the margin, right? It's not this significant move from one asset to another. It's how can we tweak to take advantage of whatever little opportunity there is to lean away from whatever area of risk. And I think what's important for investors to remember is within a diversified portfolio, it's about those little moves. It's not about taking significant action. But it's also important to remember, and Chris, I know you certainly have noted this in the past, and it's something that came up again this week as we look at some changes to the S&P 500 index, but even within our portfolio, our underlying investments change from time to time. And so you've got a company like Moderna, which has been in the news for some very important reasons with relation to the vaccine that's making its way into the S&P 500. It means there's another stock that's making its way out. It means that as you reshuffle that S&P 500 index, there are pieces that are going to be more important and less important. And I think that's an important thing for investors to remember for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, even if you're just, being a passive investor or just, holding an S&P 500 proxy, you're getting a changing basket of stocks year to year, quarter to quarter as that S&P 500 rebalances. So your example of Moderna adding into the S&P 500, we had Tesla, a few months back that was added into the S&P 500. You had a stock like Etsy that was added in as well within the year. So there's always a changing makeup. So as, the economy changes, so does that underlying holdings within the S&P 500. I mean, we used to look, quite a few years back and say, well, what percentage of the S&P 500 was energy stocks? And it used to be a very high number. Now you look at that number and you're talking just a few percent of the S&P 500 and energy stocks. So that rotation happens on its own within the market as some of these, older, slower growing businesses are replaced by quicker and new style businesses within the index themselves. And we were talking earlier about how amazing it is the size of some of these businesses that are added into the S&P 500 for the first time. Obviously Tesla is probably the most extreme example where when it was added into the S&P 500, it was the fifth largest component of the S&P 500 at addition with a $500 billion market cap. Moderna, for example, is also a $100 billion business when it entered into the S&P 500. And that speaks to both how quickly businesses can grow and scale in today's economy, as well as the maturity of, venture capital and some of the private markets, which we've discussed in the past as well.
What I appreciate about this conversation the most, I think, is that we talk so often about stretched valuations on an index. And we talk so often about how, the S&P 500 can't grow the way it grew the last 10 years. But I think we forget that the S&P 500 of the next 10 years isn't going to be the same companies that were in the S&P 500 the last 10, because it does change. And so when you talk about valuation, maybe it's not quite as fair to say that we're a little bit stretched, when you also consider that the businesses that are being added have far better growth prospects in many cases. You mentioned Tesla or Etsy or Moderna. Those are businesses that are far more relevant than a lot of those energy names that might have been leaving 5 or 10 years ago. And so I think it's one thing to say that relative to historical measures, things are a little expensive. It's another to say that, the S&P has just a broad measure of the largest businesses here in the U.S., at least the largest publicly traded businesses here in the U.S., is a good representation of where some of the best opportunity is. And then I think you add in that there's some tremendous opportunity even just to narrow that list further, either through some very specific active management or even just employing some risk controls to your portfolio. There's ways to try to get rid of even more of the names from the S&P 500 to get down to a list that really represents what some of the best opportunities are, whether that's finding names, Art, as you mentioned earlier, that are cheap, those value names, or whether it's finding those that have a bit better growth prospect but that you might have to pay up a little more for.
Yeah, I think it's always good to have a healthy agnosticism with respect to anything that's happening on any given day. And so this idea of putting Tesla into the S&P 500 and beyond that, putting Moderna into the S&P 500, I don't know a lot about either of those companies other than that I think they're pretty expensive stocks on the basis of their price-earnings multiples. So that then is making that average more expensive, which again is, in my mind, suggesting that, Kyle, as you just suggested, we should look carefully at who's managing our money. And so if you just buy an index fund, you're going to get whatever's thrown at you. It's the blend of the day. If you have a manager, that manager is going to have a specific perspective on what's going on in the economy, the world, what's going on now, what's to be expected in the future. And you can, as you suggested, tailor your portfolios so you know that there's someone watching all the time and making decisions every day and spreading it around to people with different perspectives. And that's what we do here, and it works, and we think it gives people a smoother ride than just buying that index because Moderna or Tesla or somebody might happen to be in there.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think it's important to remember that different things play different roles, right? And so it doesn't mean that you don't hold an index or it doesn't mean that you don't track an index, but it does mean that if you really do believe in diversification and you really do believe in the benefits of building a portfolio that's more than just one thing, there have to be pieces that are actively managed or that do something different than what the index is doing. And so I think, you know, as we look to how we construct portfolios for investors, what it really means to be diversified, it's got to be more than just, hey, what's happening with the index right now? So I think, you know, that certainly is a big part of what we do. Well, thank you for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.